This Stu Lectures episode features great thinker and a consummate duo, Rose Styron, recorded live at the global event in California, USA in 2014.
This has been such a special weekend. I'm so happy I've been invited. I protested a lot, but Duke and Alice and Anna and Gary and Ross and Tamara and Guy and Leon have all stood beside me and told me I have to say something. I was going to read something that I had written, but I have been assured by them that it's better to treat this as an extended dinner conversation, which to me means you better ask me questions. Because who knows? I'll talk for a bit, interrupt me, or afterwards just ask me questions. It's been amazing to be here with all of you truly good individuals. And it's just such a diverse, wonderful, dedicated group of dreamers and doers, generations mostly much younger than mine, all, it seems to me, still endeavoring to bring light and justice into an often dark, too dark, chaotic world, sometimes a brutal world, but a world that I really care about and am still that proverbial cockeyed optimist rooting for. Anyway, thank you all. I've been delighted to be here. And among these truly good individuals, ones that impressed me most and spoke to me most closely were David Sanchez and Taylor and James, all of whom survived dreadful childhoods and prison and have come out and are wonderful people still doing good work in the world. I find that totally amazing that survivors of such violence and injustice could be such wonderful people. And it highlighted for me again my lucky life, and that should be the title of this talk, My Lucky Life, because my childhood was really blessed. I was in Baltimore in a loving family, in a comfortable situation. It was still a pretty southern segregated city. It was certainly before the women's movement, and girls were supposed to let boys lead at school as well as on the dance floor, and in all sorts of southern ways. Fast forward at my wedding in Rome, which was in Italian, I had to have someone as a witness, a Princess Rospigliosi, who was at the American Academy in Rome, where I had met Bill, where he was a fellow, so that she could translate for me that I had to follow my husband everywhere and do whatever he said, not what I wanted. So that surprised me, to say the least. My eyes bulged. But back in Baltimore, I went to Quaker schools, as I was the third generation there, and was very much shaped by their commitment to peace and to public service. My father, whom I admired tremendously, who died when I was in my teens, was kind of famous in Baltimore and Washington when he was a very young man. I found a headline in the Baltimore Sun and something similar in the Washington Post on the front page saying that he was, quote, only 19 with ideas and figures at his finger ends. Took me a minute to realize it was fingertips, but not in those days. So he was a firm Republican. He learned to make money, which he had not come from. He was the youngest dispersing officer in World War I, married my mother, became a firmer Republican, but then was the first to desegregate lunch counters in Washington, and was a really good man, like all of you. Because I was the youngest child, my brother and sister were 8 and 10 years older than I. I was home alone a lot. They went off to college very early, and my parents were gone a great deal of the time. My father worked in Washington daily. My mother was a golfer, and so they went golfing places on weekends. And I was actually very happy at home alone because I'd learned to read when I was 4 and read all my parents' books, Rabindranath Tagore, Rudyard Kipling, and a lot of Planned Parenthood manuals. Then I graduated to girls' adventure stories like Nancy Drew Detective and Beverly Gray Sails to the Orient and Susanna of the Royal Mounties. So adventure was always first in my mind. And I think my life of adventure was launched at age 6 when my parents took my older siblings to Europe or the West, wherever they were going, and sent me to my little old, sweet, nearsighted grandmother in Atlantic City. And she was not the kind of grandmother who told wonderful stories that influenced writers from around the world, like Garcia Marquez and Carlos Fuentes and Kenzaburo Oe and quite a few others. I interview them for Voice of America for first Sunday every month for a long time. They've been very influenced by it, their grandmothers. But mine wasn't like that. She played Mahjong all day with her girlfriends or cousins or whoever. And she would have me set those beautiful, mysterious tiles out after breakfast, and then she'd give me a purse full of coins and say, "Go have a good time on the boardwalk, dear. Come back in time for lunch, and don't go near the water." And I was incredibly excited about this every morning, and I set off to go down the elevator with a 15-year-old elevator boy I had a crush on. And he would let me off down in the white-tiled basement of the hotel president, not the elegant hotels like the Chalfont, but it had a nice entrance to the beach, and I did not go near the water. I walked up on the boardwalk, and I had a magic morning, and then after lunch, a magic afternoon every day. I could tell you in detail, from beginning with Frailinger's saltwater taffy right after breakfast, to going to the steel pier and scaring myself in Davy Jones's locker when the, you know, with my nose pressed to the glass, and a huge fish came at me, and then climbing up to the top of the steel pier where these beautiful young girls rode their horses off the pier and down into the water. And then I'd go to the elephant house and climb up and pretend I was in Africa riding a pachyderm, and I'd go play skee ball, which I thought I was very good at. I'd go to an auction house and wonder why on earth anybody would want to buy all those horrible rugs and jewelry. And then I would go to the movies by myself. It was unrated in those days, and I was quite shocked and interested watching Hedy Lamarr climb naked out of a pool in the movie Ecstasy, and Clark Gable peering at these shadowy figures behind the window screen, the window shades, I should say, which took me back to when I was 3 and would hide under the sheet in my room every day because I imagined that the Lindbergh kidnapper, who everybody talked about, was going to come up to my window and get me. But that was all sort of delicious terror, not real fright. And that kind of really launched me, I think, onto a life of some self-confidence and a lot of curiosity and maybe thinking everything was possible. At 8, I wrote my first poem. It was about Atlantic City. My second poem was actually published. I was 9, and it was about Africa that we were studying about in our blue geography books. And I was brought up in front of the class by our wicked fourth grade teacher, Miss Rowe, and accused of plagiarism. And once I found out what plagiarism was, I was absolutely delighted that somebody thought I could have stolen that silly poem. It was dumpty-dum ballad, many, many verses. And how they thought anybody over 9 could have written it, I don't know. But it convinced me that maybe someday I could be a poet if they thought I'd taken it from a grown-up. And so I decided at 9 to be a poet, but then at 10 I thought I'd be an artist and I went to art school. And at 11 my parents took me on a trip for the very first time. They thought I was old enough. And I went to Mexico City and met Diego Rivera. And I was very impressed. I didn't know that the woman walking behind him might have been Frida Kahlo, but it was quite a studio. And when I was leaving, he leaned down to me and shook my hand and said, "I hope someday you'll be as great an artist as I am." And I said to my mother, "He's full of himself, isn't he?" However, she also bought me a drawing, which I still have. It's worth more than my house is. So I have one valuable thing over my Martha's Vineyard mantelpiece. After that, I thought maybe I'd be a singer. I went to the Peabody to study singing and trolled through Baltimore in Christmas choruses and sang through Gilbert and Sullivan in high school, and then felt poetry was it. So that's what I was doing. I was a poet at college and at graduate school. And then I went off to Rome and met Bill Styron the same night that I met Truman Capote. I think I've told that story before. Briefly, I didn't remember Bill Styron, who had been talking to our writing classes at Johns Hopkins after he wrote his first book, Lie Down in Darkness. And we poets and critics looked down on novelists and thought that he was much too nervous and shallow, and I had no memory of him. And then in Rome, he asked me for a date. It was actually because his professor, my professor was his close friend, and he'd written me saying, "If you ever get up to the American Academy, look up Bill Styron. He just arrived. He doesn't know anybody." And he was the one who had brought Bill to Johns Hopkins. So I was up at the Academy a couple of weeks later with a very, very boring date and this beautiful Stanford White Academy, which I love. And as I was leaving, thinking, well, I guess I'll never get up here again, I passed the little cubby holes, which had the fellows' names in. and I saw Bill Styron. So I put a note with my phone number in saying Lewis Rubin, who was the professor, said to say hello. I'm in Rome, call me if you want to. And he called right away. He professed remembering me, which was impossible, because I hadn't even talked to him after the speech. But there was only one other girl in the class, so maybe he looked at both of us. And so I said, sure, I'd meet him at the little cafe bar at the down in the basement of the beautiful Hotel Excelsior in the middle of Rome. And as I was going down the little narrow steps to the bar, I thought, oh, I wonder if I'll recognize him. I remembered how nervous and shaky he was when I had seen him in Baltimore. And I thought, seems to me he was tall and thin. And when I got downstairs, there was only one table with three people at it. And on the left was a very short fellow with a ton of black curly hair. And on the right was Truman Capote, who looked exactly like the languishing blonde childlike figure on the back of Other Voices, Other Rooms, which I had just read. So I was delighted to meet him. And in the middle was tall, thin Bill Styron, still shaking because he had a fear of heights, and he had just come down from the top of St. Peter's with his old girlfriend. And I thought he was pretty cute, even if he was shaking. And so I made a big mistake. Truman Capote and the other guy, a painter from the Academy, began saying how wonderful Bill's book, Lie Down in Darkness, was. And I heard myself say, oh yes, wonderful book. I hadn't read it, of course. And when he asked me out the next day to come the next night, I thought, oh boy, I better find that book somewhere in Rome. So I went all over looking for it and couldn't find it anywhere. But I went just before they closed to the American Library in Rome and asked for it by its title. And they said, oh yes, we have it. And in those days, it was all the books in the American libraries abroad have opaque covers with a little plastic see-through on the spine so you can read the title. So I filled out a card, took the book to my little apartment I was sharing, sat up, turned to chapter one, read a chapter, and then another chapter, and closed the book thinking, well, he's cute, but he can't write. So I thought, what am I going to say when I have a date with him tonight? Well, tomorrow night. So the next morning, I woke up and I opened the book to the title page, and it was Lie Down in Darkness by Harold Hayes. And I learned that you couldn't copyright a title. So I told Bill that night, and he thought it was funny and gave me his copy of his book, which was, of course, wonderful. And that started a romance between us, which had many twists and turns for 6 months. And then we got married in Rome. Meantime, he had taken me to Paris to meet all the guys that he had started the Paris Review with in the months before I met him in Rome. George Plimpton, Peter Matheson, lots of others. And we had a splendid time, split up for a while. I went to Florence, finally came back. And my mother, and by this time we had moved in together next door to the American Academy, and my mother arrived and was staying at the American Embassy with our then ambassador, who was a friend of hers, and discovered that I was living with Bill Styron, which was not to be approved in those days. We're in the 50s now. But she invited him to the embassy with me because she wanted to look him over. And Bill, who had recently gotten out of the Marines and was still wearing his khakis most of the time, had had to go buy a suit for when he got the Prix de Rome. And he went down to the Bowery in New York and bought a three-piece light blue sharkskin suit, quite baggy. And he didn't have a tie, so he asked his friend Truman Capote, who, whether as a joke or whether it was the only one he had, gave him a lavender burlap tie with a big red heart in the middle and white arrows through it and gray fringe on the bottom. My mother was a Baltimore fashion plate, and she did not approve at all. But anyway, we had some adventures, and when she finished her tour of Europe, and she and I had been on tours before after my father died, she called me from Cherbourg and said, "I've had a wonderful time. Dear, the best part was being with you in Rome." And by this time I said, "Mom, I have wonderful news for you. I'm going to marry Bill Styron." There was a click, nothing. And the next thing I knew, she had put a detective on Bill's Southern family. And there were all sorts, I won't go into all those very funny details. But in May, when my brother was coming for the first time to Rome, Peter Matheson and George Plimpton went to meet him at the airport and said, "Your sister's getting married at the Campidoglio." And I had not invited my mother because I was scared to, and Bill had not invited his father because his father had married his wicked stepmother after his own mother had died at 13. And so we just had all our wonderful friends. Everybody came from Paris because Erwin Shaw said, "You have to come to this wedding. After all, a guy only gets married two or three times in his life." So they all came, and they all, and several of them came on our honeymoon with us in Ravello, which lasted about 8 months. And then we all, one by one, went back to New York. Bill said, "It's too beautiful here. I can't possibly write." He was in the middle of his of another novel. He had written a novella in between that had been published, and now he was on to his second big novel, which he didn't finish. And as soon as we got back to New York, which he had said he hated, he said Italy was too beautiful. He couldn't bear just walking out into those gorgeous gardens and down to the beach every day. The proprietor of the hotel had turned the basement jail of this beautiful palazzo into a honeymoon flat for us, looking out over the Amalfi Coast and over beautiful vineyards and trees like you have here. I would have stayed forever, but since I followed my husband everywhere, we got on this before Christmas on this terrible boat, third class, Bill happily up in his bunk, writing every day as he did all of his life, and I throwing up over the side until we got back to New York. And then we went from New York to Long Island, living next door to Peter and his wife for a while. They and their baby had come on our honeymoon with us. And then we bought a place in Connecticut, and never left. We were there for 50 beautiful years, had a wonderful family, 4 children, and terrific neighbors. And I got involved, as did Bill, with politics and journalism. We got to know a few presidents, as one of them has just told you, and we had jaunts everywhere. We met a lot of extraordinary people, some of them leaders like the Clintons, the Kennedys, Václav Havel, Nelson Mandela. We even went to Mexico with your with Carlos Fuentes and your governor, Jerry Brown, and a la California. I remember Arnold Schwarzenegger in Lederhosen on my porch when he was courting Maria Shriver. That was Martha's Vineyard. And we also had a lot of special Connecticut neighbors. Nobody was really well known then, but you'll know their names now. Arthur Miller, Richard Widmark, Philip Roth, Frank McCourt, Mia Farrow, Leonard Bernstein, Vladimir Horowitz, etc., etc. They all settled in or near Roxbury. And there was a lot of music made all the time. Leonard Bernstein would come every Christmas and play all the Christmas carols on our old Steinway piano, and then ham it up afterwards in many accents, and our children and their children and the neighbors' children all took the same parts every year for at least a decade and hammed it up. And then for Bill's birthday, and I had not had the piano tuned, Vladimir Horowitz came and started to play Happy Birthday and frowned at the sound and got up and left at that point. So after that, I had the piano tuned quite often. Anyway, we all had a wonderful time in Roxbury, Connecticut. We all brought our children up together, sent them to school, and they're all still friends of each other, as are we. But 1968, which was after my fourth child had been born, was a year which was a wake-up call for all of us. There were the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King following the earlier 60s of Jack Kennedy. It was a pretty distressing year. We had all been involved in the civil rights movement. I'd been involved in the beginning of the women's movement through Gloria Steinem, although I didn't participate in it as much as I should have. So when Bill and I were invited to go to an Afro-Asian writers conference in Russia, although Bill hated to travel, he said, let's go, let's get out of here. And he was being honored at the Frankfurt Book Fair for his book, The Confessions of Nat Turner. So we went to the book fair and planned to go from there on the once a week flight to Moscow to the conference. And as the day we were leaving, Daniel Cohn-Bendit, Danny the Red, some of you of my generation may remember from being on the barricades in Paris that year, and I had been there when he was doing that. He was leading a protest outside our hotel with hundreds of students, and I joined him and then found out that it was protesting President Senghor of Senegal, who, although a poet, had put writers and other dissidents in prison and was treating them very, very badly. I had to get out of that protest and go back to our hotel because we were leaving for Moscow that day. And the only way to get out of the hotel was through the back door in the basement. So I stole a porter's dolly and we put our bags on it and rumbled our way to the airport And once we got the bags onto the airport and were walking on, we discovered that the Soviet Union was busy invading Czechoslovakia. But it was too late for us to back out. So when we got to Moscow, we were met by a lot of Russian writers, Yevtushenko, the poet, leading them. And we persuaded them all to have a small vocal protest to their government about the invasion. And they sent us all quickly to Tashkent in Middle Asia, where they couldn't hear any of us. And because we were not under surveillance there, I got to meet so many extraordinary writers from around the world who were approved by the Soviet Union for their politics as well as their writing. We were the only Americans there. I'd been invited along with Bill because they thought he was a good revolutionary, with Nat Turner, and because I had translated a lot of Russian poetry. And meeting all the writers there and walking around the melon markets and the other markets and ruins of Tashkent and Samarkand, I learned about all the dreadful prisons, the gulags, as they were called, of the world. And many of the writers had been through it, had their families lost in them. And the details obviously appalled me. They all asked if I would bring their manuscripts back to the U.S. and get them translated for them, which I did at Yale. I mean, I couldn't do it, but I gave them to Yale. I then went to Washington thinking I would bring the news of all the terrible stuff that was going on to the State Department. They patted me on the head and said, "Nice lady, go home." And I went home and talked to my neighbor, Philip Roth, whose girlfriend had just joined the very first group of Amnesty International, talked me into coming to New York with her for that. And at that moment, I embarked on what turned out to be a lifelong, now 45-year commitment to human rights. The movement was just beginning then, and I'm still around with Amnesty and other human rights groups that are spin-offs of it and do a lot of wonderful things that Amnesty doesn't do. There's so much to be done. I'm not going to go through all my trips, which were all around the world for Amnesty, but I'll just cite briefly my first mission for Amnesty, which changed my life even more. It was to Chile at the height of Pinochet's coup. And I took my 17-year-old daughter, who spoke wonderful Spanish, with me. I'm a terrible linguist, and I thought, I'll get everybody into trouble if they tell me things that I won't understand. And it was a good thing I took her along. We played mother and daughter on Christmas vacation. It was right after Christmas and New Year's, January of 1974. I wasn't allowed to write anything down. I had to memorize it all. I put a few things in code that I had to try to figure out when I got home. The idea was that because all of President Allende's ministers, after he was killed in the Moneda by Pinochet's men, were scattered in unknown places all around Chile. Some were being tortured, some had died, some were escaping. And Madame Allende, the president's widow, was to speak at the UN in 3 weeks. And the UN wanted to have information about where these people were so she could help get them out, help mobilize the UN to help, hopefully to destroy Pinochet. That, of course, didn't happen. But I wasn't allowed to write anything down or to call anybody up on the phone. I just had to go to this list of people they'd given me, and about the fourth person, fourth household I approached, was the wife of the Lutheran minister. He was somewhere sequestered, but she took us in, and she said she would gather all her women friends whose husbands had been abducted, and if my daughter and I would go to a particular swimming pool on the edge of town, she would have all her women friends, their wives, come in disguise. We should play with this huge red beach ball in the water, and they would come one by one and give me all the information I needed, tell me and then tell my daughter, so we had it. And that's the way I got information out. We barely got out alive. We had quite a time. I got everything copied for us in the underground Solidarity so that I could sneak it out. But we were mistaken for, I was mistaken for Charles Horman's wife. I don't know if you all saw the movie Missing. Sissy Spacek played it, played Joyce. We were followed everywhere. We became friends with the Hormans, who were the only other Americans in the hotel right across from the Moneda. And we found Horman, Charles Horman, in the morgue. We had many other adventures with people in Chile, but the one which really changed my mind about being an American was when Susanna, my daughter, and I went to Valparaiso, because the underground had asked us to go away while they copied things, and we were being followed everywhere in town. In Valparaiso, we spotted the American Navy as well as the tall ships of Chile, and someone who knew who we were came out and walked along with me, and then another friend came and walked along with us, and they told us that these tall ships were being used as torture ships for Allende's ministers, and that the American Navy had come down to surround and protect these ships, and that Henry Kissinger had destabilized Chile from his position as Secretary of State, supporting Pinochet's coup, allowing the death of Allende, and being Mr. Bad Guy. And it was my first time losing faith in the American government. I came back. I got out because of Teddy Kennedy and a postcard I'd faked. I won't go into that now. But Teddy wanted me to come and shake Kissinger's hand, and I refused, and the light bulbs went off. And I have had a lifelong feud with Kissinger, with some very amusing moments. But I then went on with Amnesty to Ireland during the Troubles, to Poland during its particular troubles. I went to all over Africa and all over Latin America, and in some places in Asia. So my desire to travel got satisfied in one way. And then I went with Peter Matheson and a birder named Victor Emmanuel to Africa with my children on a venture, on their first wildlife venture, using Amnesty, using it as a cover for Amnesty, because I was going through Africa to look for a man who had disappeared after that, and got hooked on birding. So for the next 30 years, sometimes I went out for human rights work, and sometimes I simply went on wildlife trips and had the wonderful life of travel. I had, you know, started out being political, marching on Washington. I'd moved on to international travel, wonderful, wonderful places that I'd been. And then my husband got sick. I came back home for a long time. Obviously had grief, solitude, but was on beautiful Martha's Vineyard. So I wrote a lot of poetry, and my wonderful family stood by me. I made many pals. Great friendships emerged from those days on the vineyard, and I moved there permanently. And I have a lot of funny stories, but I can't possibly tell them now. So I will just finish by saying how many of you inspired me, and if I have any advice to give from here, it's be open to everything. You know, expand your life anytime you have a chance. Don't say no. Add tracks when they appear. And in general, seize the day. Okay.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.